Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferentz.
Strike at Kellogg's over. Workers get a five-year deal, but not all are happy. Meanwhile, retail workers getting ready for the next election at Amazon in Alabama. And today on the show, the Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO and the Office of Professional Employees. Welcome to the Thursday, December 23rd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. Mr. Bill Samuel, longtime contributor and supporter of America's Workforce, comes to us from the AFL-CIO, where he works as the Government Affairs Director. He's going to be our first guest. And the primary topic, at least in the first segment with Bill, is going to be the Build Back Better legislation, which, as you know, has been tabled for this year. Many are saying, hopefully the Democrats are going to get together and try to come to some resolve. And the polling shows, and this is in Joe Manchin's state, 68% of West Virginia voters support the Build Back Better Act. Yesterday, we talked about the mine worker, Cecil Roberts, not happy with Joe. He said that, we've had a long and friendly relationship. We remain grateful for Joe's hard work, but he's got to take a look at what's in this bill a little bit more, because it will protect coal miners. Yeah. That's just one of many comments. Lee Saunders of AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, says there's no excuse for not getting this done. Now is the time for Congress to deliver to the American people a better future by finally passing legislation to lower costs for life-saving medications, expand access to essential child care services, and provide relief from a still ongoing pandemic that has devastated communities all around the country. Now, he mentioned child care services. That's the child tax credit. And the rumor has been that Manchin feels some people are using that money to buy drugs. Now I'm hearing that there would be income guidelines. You don't get the credit if you're making over $200,000 a year. All this will be in the discussion mode with Bill Samuel in our first segment. Then we're going to kind of recap the year. I mean, a lot of good things happened this year. Yeah, the American Rescue Plan, the infrastructure bill, $1.2 trillion. That's really going to remake America. And Bill's going to make some predictions about 2022. We got the midterm elections. How are the Democrats going to do? Well, it's really early to tell right now, but we will speculate. Also, one more thing. Biden is winding down his first year in office, having already made significant headway on one of his most lasting legacies, judicial confirmations. I've said this many times on the show, presidents leave a mark on their presidency by who they put on the federal benches, and there are many, many, many federal judicial positions in the country. Biden has already confirmed 40 lifetime federal judges this year. That breaks down to 11 appeals court judges, 29 district court judges. And for the comparison to Trump and Obama, Trump had confirmed a total of 18 appeals and district court judges in his first year in office. Obama, 12. Right now, Biden stands at 40. Again, lifetime appointments. Tim Lasker is going to be our second guest on the show. He comes to us from the Office of Professional Employees. And this is Local 453 out of Massachusetts. And you know what they are? They're a management union. When I first saw that, I said, wait a minute. You got management, you got the workers. This is a management union. They represent a segment of the employees of the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. About 400 of the authority's employees from nearly every department, we're talking technical, professional, clerical, and supervisory positions. OPEIU453.org is their website. And they're classified as the MBTA Management Union. They were chartered back in 1973. Their mission is to protect the rights, economic well-being, and general welfare of the professional office and clerical employees at the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. And apparently, well, there's some finance shenanigans going on there, double standard. And apparently, they got some of the money from the CARES Act in March, April of 2020 to balance their budget. That wasn't enough. There was a push to increase the gas tax. I believe that did not happen. Bottom line is, there's a lot of people, especially in the Northeast, that use transit. I mean, it's very, very popular. Amtrak, very, very popular in the Northeast. And a lot of people rely on it, especially lower income people, and they're not getting the job done. So Tim Lasker will talk about that and more as our second guest on the show today. Well, after a strike that began on October 5th, the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers members have approved a new five-year contract that includes no takeaways, no concessions. The workers at cereal plants in Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Omaha, Nebraska, and Memphis, Tennessee, voted this week in favor of a new agreement, which includes no permanent two-tier system, a clear path to regular full-time employment, no plant shutdowns through October 2026, increases in pension payments, and the maintenance of cost of living raises. Comment from Anthony Shelton. Anthony is the international president of the Bakers Union. He says, our striking members at Kellogg's ready-to-eat cereal production facilities courageously stood their ground and sacrificed so much in order to achieve a fair contract. The agreement makes gains and does not include any concessions. Our entire union commends and thanks Kellogg's members from picket line to picket line. Union members stood strong and undeterred in this fight, inspiring generations of workers across the globe who were energized by their tremendous show of bravery as they stood up to fight and never once backed down. The union is grateful as well for the outpouring of fraternal support we receive from across the labor movement for our striking members at Kellogg's. Solidarity was critical to this great workers' victory. And they had a lot of support from people like Marty Walsh. Even President Biden spoke out about what was going on. And they had threatened. Now, they gave them a contract. This was a couple of weeks ago, and they rejected it, saying that they were going to go ahead and hire replacement workers. And the workers took action on that, fought back, said this is not going to happen. They went online and actually filled out fake applications for jobs at Kellogg's, and that really ticked off the company. Now, not everybody is happy. You know how these things go. The two-tier compensation system, it doesn't do away with it. And let me explain. Instead, the contract merely provides a limited avenue for lower-tier employees to attain senior status and benefits. Now, Mr. Shelton, the president, described the agreement as a fair one and makes gains. However, Trevor Bittleman, who's a worker at Kellogg's and the president of the union's local Grand Rapids chapter, expressed disappointment in the contract, noting that Kellogg's replacement threat might have swayed the vote. Nevertheless, as the Huffington Post reported yesterday, Bittleman said he was proud of the workers who took to the picket lines and stayed out this long, describing the strike as a huge step that inspired many, many people. So, strike is over. started on October 5th. Nice Christmas gift there for the workers. With the new union election set to take place at the Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama, in the next coming months, the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, which is affiliated with the UFCW, is pushing the case for why organizing workers at the retail giant will be a win-win for Amazon employees and the global economy. Stuart Applebaum heads the union, and he recently wrote a joint editorial on the topic with Sharon Graham. Sharon is the General Secretary of the United Kingdom's Unite the Union, along with Christy Hoffman, General Secretary of the UNI Global Union. And this is what it says. Without a strong voice on the job, workers will never get a fair chance when facing a corporation that has so much influence over commerce, the future of work, and our data. The first step to overhauling the company's systemic problems is to shift more power to Amazon workers. We know that workers can be agents for change when they join together, as we saw on Black Friday, when thousands of Amazon warehouse workers and allies in more than 20 countries across six continents protested and went on strike as part of a global push to make Amazon pay. In the meantime, Amazon workers are speaking out as the company continues its rollback. Why they're doing this, I don't know. Rollback of COVID-19 safety protocols amid spikes in cases. It's ridiculous what's going on right now. But listen to this. According to a new report, Amazon warehouse workers across the country have noticed a marked rise in confirmed COVID-19 cases at various facilities. This includes two Oregon warehouses where still active outbreaks have been ongoing for more than 565 days, as well as two California warehouses subject to Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspections due to COVID complaints. Well, despite what's going on, Amazon has relaxed certain COVID safety measures, such as mask mandates and 20-minute breaks, while suspending orders such as on-location testing. Let's hope that turns around. This is ridiculous, especially with the pickup of the Omicron virus. All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, Bill Samuel of the AFL-CIO.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers, affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. And if you missed our segment with Melissa Cropper, president of the OFT, just go to awfradio.com, and it's posted there. And we have all the shows posted for, my gosh, two decades at least. Let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars, Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. AFLCIO.org is their website. Mr. Samuel, Merry Christmas. How are we doing today?
Same to you. Happy holidays. We're doing good.
All right. What a crazy week here. I guess you didn't see, or we didn't expect Joe Biden to go on Fox and say he's not going to vote for Build Back Better, at least in its current form. I think that took you and just so many people by surprise. And this comes despite the fact that the polling, just saw this out of West Virginia, almost 70% of the people there want the legislation to pass. So,
yeah.
Bill, unwind all this for me. Yeah, unwind. Yeah. It's been a crazy week. Go ahead.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. It's really extremely perplexing. Manchin went on TV Sunday, gave the White House, I think, about an hour's warning, and then wouldn't take a call from the president who tried to talk him out of it. At least that's how the story goes. He had been, you know, negotiating with the White House. I think as late as last week they had been trading proposals. I do think this took people by surprise. Others say it shouldn't have because he was never that close and just wanted to make a clean break. But, you know, I think he's going to come back to it. I mean, just within this last week since Sunday, there have been renewed conversations. I wouldn't say negotiations, but conversations with Senator Manchin in the White House. We've talked to him. He's not, you know, ruling out any Build Back Better legislation. He probably would like to have the name changed, take credit for that. But he is, there are lots of provisions he likes. You know, there's a lot of overlap between what we think is important on energy and health care and education and, you know, the care economy. There are lots of things he likes. He, you know, there are some disagreements about how to pay for it, how long the program should last. These are things that can be worked out. But we're really disappointed. We wanted this done. I mean, we need this. It's been, I don't know, 6 months of negotiations. The House passed it quite a while ago. So anyway, bottom line is we hope in January, with a little bit of rest between now and then, people will get back to the table. We're going to keep pressing for it. We are not backing off of this, as well as the need for this voting rights legislation to pass quickly. They may come back to that first. We can talk about that in a moment.
It's funny you bring that up because I was talking about Cecil Roberts. You know Cecil Roberts, who heads the Mine Workers Union, and I know you worked with the miners for many, many years before you came to the AFL-CIO, and they're really upset with Manchin. I mean, they still are friends and all that, but I think a lot of it has to do with the way he did this. I mean, just abruptly saying no, then going on Fox and cozying up. And now, I think, what was it, McConnell is now saying, hey, you ought to come over to the GOP side? I mean, there's so much at play right now. But getting back to the miners, isn't there legislation packed into Build Back Better that will deal with black lung and disability benefits, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a bill that ordinarily would be a what they call a budget reconciliation bill. It's been renamed this year the Build Back Better Act, but budget reconciliation is where you put programs that need to be continued, like black lung. So there is a, you know, small part of this, you know, massive bill that continues benefits and funding of the black lung program. So yeah, by saying you've had it with Build Back Better, it sort of suggests, you know, that you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. And he does not intend to do that. Obviously, he wants to maintain the black lung program, but he's going to have to get back to the negotiating table. You know, in the labor movement, we know what this is about. Sometimes you're trying to get leverage, make a statement, put people off guard. I mean, there's, you know, these are negotiating tactics. And I think that's all this is. I think this is his effort to say, wait a minute, you're not going to pressure me into doing something I don't want to do. But it's not the whole bill he doesn't like. It's just particular features. And now we like the whole bill. I mean, but there's going to be a discussion, obviously, in January, and hopefully quickly, to figure out where the overlap is between what the president really wants, what the country needs, and what Joe Manchin is willing to sign off on. It's unfortunate that this is all, you know, one man, you know, gets to make this decision for the rest of the country. I think his colleagues are furious. You know, 49 senators or at least 48. Not clear where Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona is. She's much less public about her concerns. But certainly 48 Democratic senators are for this bill as it stands. And it passed the House with, I think, 220 Democrats voting for it. So he's really one person is holding this up. And that doesn't seem to weigh too heavily on him. But as I said, I think he'll be back at the table after the first of the year, and we'll get a deal, hopefully within a few weeks. That's certainly our goal.
So we need 50 votes, and then Kamala Harris would be 51, and
that's right.
This is done.
And there's only very few pieces of legislation that can pass with a simple majority like that. Treaties, nominations, and budget reconciliation. It's a quirk of the traditions in the Senate that for the last 40 years they've decided that they can pass budget, an annual budget, with 51 votes, so they can't be filibustered. Otherwise, you'd have no budget, and the minority would really run the place. Frankly, we think the minority already runs the place because everything else takes 60. You can filibuster, and it takes 60 votes to shut off debate. But you can't do it on budget reconciliation, and so that's why everything's been packed into this by the Democrats, because it's the only way they're going to get their agenda through. It's how they got the last COVID bill done, was using a reconciliation procedure, so they only needed 51 votes. And no Republican voted for it, the American Rescue Plan.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a good reason that the Democrats use the reconciliation process and try to fit as much into it as possible. We've talked before that one of the features of this bill is labor reform. We've got penalties for the first time that can be assessed against companies that violate the National Labor Relations Act in this reconciliation bill. We want to make sure that is part of the final package as well.
Yeah, Cecil Roberts of the Miners Union brought that up, and he also talked about the voting rights, because he said, we got to do something in America because of these voter suppression laws now in 19 states. Getting back to Kyrsten Sinema, I don't know how you pronounce her name.
Yeah.
She's kind of quiet. I'm leery there. What? We don't know how she's going to go on this.
Well, she doesn't really talk to outsiders. I mean, I assume she talks to her colleagues. She refuses to meet with almost anybody in Arizona. It's a very peculiar pattern of behavior. She'll give groups in Arizona, her own voters, a few minutes, on a Zoom call to talk to her. Mostly she sends her staff out. She doesn't talk to reporters. Again, I'm sure she talks to her colleagues. We hear from Democratic leadership that they expect that once Joe Manchin is satisfied with this bill, she'll go along with it. She did say she didn't want to see any rolling back of the Trump tax cuts, and that was very disappointing and surprising for a member of the Democratic caucus. She voted against the Trump tax cuts. And of course, we have to roll back some of them to make sure we have the revenue to pay for this Build Back Better Act.
Right.
Now, the Democrats have done some workarounds, or now they've increased the so-called corporate minimum tax. They've instituted a millionaire surtax as part of the Build Back Better to pay for it. And they're coming up with, $1.8 trillion, something like that, in tax increases. But the Trump tax cuts themselves are pretty much left intact, simply because Kyrsten Sinema said she wouldn't vote to roll them back. And this is another odd situation. Manchin would like to cancel the Trump tax cuts to pay for this. So now we've got this disagreement between those two. poor Chuck Schumer, majority leader. Every member of his caucus, as Joe Biden said a couple of weeks ago, is president. they get to make these decisions, by themselves.
How's Biden holding up? You're close to him in the AFL-CIO headquarters.
You
have a lot of contact with him. But, this has been a crazy year for him, and it's not even a full year yet. But what are you hearing?
Yeah, he's very patient. He was in the Senate for, I think, 40 years, something like that. So he's been through this process before. It's never been quite as tied up as it is now. I think there's only been a 50-50 Senate once in that period. It didn't last long, when the vice president was called on to break ties. But he seems patient and he's focused. I don't think he's lost his ambition here. But it is a tough situation, and he and Joe Manchin are reported to have a decent relationship. They actually never served together. He was vice president when Joe Manchin was elected to the Senate, but they've obviously known each other, and they know each other's types. You know, politicians who have served for some time and like the process of negotiation, and putting together legislative deals. They're sort of both deal makers. So that's why I'm optimistic. You know, Trump was terrible at this. It's funny, you know, he always talked about himself being the great deal maker. They passed virtually nothing in his 4 years. They couldn't even get an infrastructure bill done when he had majorities in the House and Senate. So at least Biden is good at this, I think. We'll see. I mean, we're going to have to get some big results here in the next few weeks, as I said, when they come back.
Now, when do they come back?
They come back. The Senate comes back on the 3rd. Okay. Of January, that Monday. It'll take a while to get started, I think. They've done a lot of nominations, executive branch, judicial branch. So it's not like they've been wasting time, but they haven't passed any major pieces of legislation since the infrastructure bill back in, I think it was early October, I guess. I think it was, or maybe mm-hmm. late October. And that was a big bill. It was $1 trillion in spending, the biggest infrastructure bill we've seen, and people have almost forgotten about it now because of the controversy around Build Back Better. But they have done a lot. The rescue plan, almost $2 trillion to deal with COVID back in the spring, and now the infrastructure they've done. So they've done a lot, but they've had a lot more to do, and we're hoping to get it done quickly.
I hear you. Well, let's tear that apart in the next segment and also look ahead to 2022. Bill Samuel on our live line. Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation, Tim Lasker, will be joining us on behalf of the Office of Professional Employees, and they represent management in Massachusetts. Interesting scenario, and we'll talk about it. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we are available on 6 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always like those 5-star ratings. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. Speaking of which, we have Mr. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line, and he is the Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. It's been quite a couple of weeks here talking about Build Back Better, but let's kind of do a recap here because Biden gets into office January 20th, and right away he got to work, made some major, major changes at the National Labor Relations Board. And Bill, I think we're seeing a lot of the effects of those changes, don't you think?
Yeah, well, we have a very aggressive general counsel who really decides what cases will be taken up, and then the board, makes the final decision. And we do have now a 3-2 Democratic confirmed National Labor Relations Board for the first time in many years, and they're doing a great job. The general counsel you know, has an ambitious agenda. She really believes in what the law is supposed to do, which is protect workers and punish companies that violate, you know, the basic right to organize and bargain. And we haven't had a board this focused on making the Labor Relations Act a reality, the promise of the act a reality. So her name is Jennifer Abruzzo. She came from CWA, by the way. She had been at the board as a staffer and then was associate general counsel at the communications workers for many years. And now she's the general counsel, really, you know, sort of setting a course that we think is very favorable for organizing and bargaining. She's even talked about revisiting whether in fact it is legal to replace strikers. You know, by board law, it was decided many years ago that companies could replace strikers with permanent replacements during economic strikes as opposed to unfair labor practice strikes. She wants to review that.
Yeah.
You know, she wants to review all kinds of things that people thought, you know, had been settled by earlier decisions. She thinks many of those decisions were probably wrongly decided, and she's going to try to get them reconsidered. So we're very happy with that.
Speaking of the replacement workers, did you hear what the striking Kellogg's workers, they settled their dispute, but did you hear what they did when Kellogg's announced that they were going to be replaced? Did you catch that story?
No, what the union did.
Yeah, well, what the workers did. I don't know if the union sanctioned it, but they filled out, they went to a number of online platforms because Kellogg said that, you know, they were going to hire. So they opened up a couple portals. Well, they fired off a bunch of fake applications.
I did see that. I did very clever use of, right, of the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, that reminds me of when Trump had that rally. This is back a year and a half ago, and he was, you know, he had a certain number of seats and spaces available, and kids, you know, young people from all over the world signed up to get tickets, and then of course had no intention of showing up.
Right.
So they filled them all up, and then nobody came to the rally, and Trump was beside himself.
Yeah. 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 You know, with the internet, anything could happen. I mean, it's so funny. So
that's
funny.
Right.
But yeah, it's a new day at the NLRB. And in fact, I was just talking at the beginning of the show, Stuart Applebaum is getting ready for the next vote at Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama. And that would not happen if it wasn't for Jennifer Abruzzo and, well, the team over there.
Right. That's
absolutely right.
Yep. Yep. And they've, you know, they restored the right of, you know, college teaching assistants to organize and bargain. They are bringing the law back to where it should have been, and under Trump, and really going back to the Reagan board and the Bush board, and when a lot of these rights were rolled back and curtailed, I think this board is going to open them back up, and that's great. Now we got to protect it, which means we have to keep electing Democratic presidents, because Republican presidents have a pretty, you know, clear history now of putting management lawyers on the NLRB. That's what they do,
and
ideologues. So.
And very conservative judges in lifetime appointments. We should note that in the first year, and it's not even a whole year here, Biden has appointed and confirmed. They've confirmed 40 lifetime judges this year, which breaks down to 11 appeals judges, 29 district court judges, and that goes back to tying Reagan. Reagan had 40 when he took office in his first year. But compare that to Donald Trump, we're looking at 18 in his first year, Obama 12. And this is important. Maybe you could touch on this, because judges have a lot of power. And I'd like to hear your analysis of that for our listeners.
Yeah, this is really sort of a, you know, below the radar for most Americans, but it is extremely important. I mean, you look at all the decisions that not just the Supreme Court, but as you said, circuit courts and district courts make about all kinds of federal regulations and laws that work their way up through the courts when they're challenged. And, you know, we have seen Trump, and not to mention election challenges, which even some of the Trump judges, confirmed judges, went against Trump. And thank God, you know, it was, I think, 61 of 62 cases were tossed out, election challenges, and some of those were Trump judges. But by and large, it's really important to get good, fair judges. And one of the big things that Biden has really, I think, pioneered here is not putting, corporate lawyers and professors only on the courts. He has public defenders, union lawyers. He's really broken out of the mold here in putting together a very diverse set of judges who've gotten confirmed because we have 51 votes in the Senate. The vice president has had to break numerous ties to get these 40 judges confirmed, and as you said, their lifetime. Now, the Supreme Court is one of the weaker spots here because, you know, Trump got to appoint three of them.
Right.
So there's a 6-3 majority now of Republicans, three appointed by one president, Donald Trump. It's just a quirk that there was, you know, three retirements and deaths when he was the 4 years he was president. So hopefully Biden will have a chance to rebalance that. There's talk about expanding the size of the court. I don't think that will happen, but it's very important. I mean, all these election challenges to the Affordable Care Act, challenges to the vaccine mandates are going to work their way to the court. Roe
right.
v. Wade, all kinds of things.
Certainly very aggressive on behalf of President Biden on that first year regarding the federal judges. Let's move on to voting rights. Where are we with legislation? Because I know there's been some stumbling blocks. I know the Republicans are dead set on this, but something's got to happen because the states are really turning the screws when it comes to voter suppression. I believe we're up to 19 states now that have passed laws, right?
This is going to be fascinating when they come back because we do now have a proposal, the Freedom to Vote Act, which restores, automatic registration, minimum standards for early voting, mail-in ballots, drop boxes, all the things that Republican states are rolling back to make it harder to vote. The Freedom to Vote Act would protect. It would restore them and all. It would set federal guidelines. This is exactly what we need. We now have 50 Democrats who say they support it. Even Joe Manchin, who helped negotiate this deal, this Freedom to Vote Act. So it's ready to be passed with Kamala Harris breaking the tie. The problem is, it's not budget reconciliation, so it can be filibustered. So we would need 60 votes, and you're not going to get probably a single Republican. McConnell has made that clear. So Democrats are either going to have to vote to change the Senate rules and eliminate the possibility of a filibuster or make it much more difficult to filibuster, or this will never pass, and our elections will come. You know, we will now be one of the lesser democracies, and there's been a lot of international criticism of the direction our elections are taking. Now, Manchin, we are told, is open to a change in the Senate rules because he acknowledges that Senate doesn't work that well when the minority can control everything. So he's talking about the possibility of what they call a talking filibuster. You know, in the old days, you had to stay on the Senate floor and talk to keep from getting to a vote. Now you just basically raise your hand and say, "I object," and then go home. And under current filibuster rules, that's all it takes. The side that wants to have a vote has to all show up and provide 60 votes to shut off debate. Anyway, it gets very complicated. But the fact is, Manchin seems willing to look at the rules. Sinema may be less inclined, and we're going to have all 50 vote to change the rules to get a vote on this really important legislation. And they're going to have to do it quickly because redistricting is happening. Republicans are abusing that, carving up the country and eliminating Democratic districts, minority districts, in all kinds of, even in Ohio, what I've read, you probably know more about than I do. So the Democrats are going to have to pull themselves together and pass the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act really within 2 to 3 weeks in January. And to do that, they're going to have to vote to change the Senate rules.
Now, changing the Senate rules, they've done that in years past, right?
They've done it dozens and dozens of times. They've even changed the number of votes it takes to break a filibuster. It used to be 67, now it's 60. Then they passed the Budget Act in 1974, so now you have reconciliation, which you can't filibuster. They passed Fast Track, which enables you to pass trade bills with 50 votes. Just a couple of years ago, McConnell changed the rules to confirm a Supreme Court nominee with 50 votes. It used to take 60. You could filibuster a nomination. So there's nothing sacred about these rules. They're not in the Constitution. They're made up by previous Senate majorities, and We now have a slim majority, and they should change the rules to make it possible to actually pass the agenda that, you know, the American people voted for last November. So this is what we're hoping, and I think there's some daylight here for Manchin and Sinema, hopefully, to agree to. Otherwise, you know, we're really not going to have free and fair elections, and that is what our democracy depends
on. Yeah, good point. Really good point. And you know what, Bill? You know this. People want Congress to get things done. And the way it's configured right now, it can't get done. And obviously, you got Manchin and Sinema. That's another story by itself. But there's so much frustration out there. And primarily, that's why a lot of people have given up on the system. They don't even bother to vote anymore because of that.
Right.
So if they can get things done and get legislation passed, I mean, it's sad that we had the American Rescue Plan with no Republican support, although the Republicans are taking credit for that in their various districts. Have you noticed
that?
That's
right. You know what? They're going to take credit for the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
And no House Republican voted for that. It did get out of the Senate with Senate Republicans voting for it, which is kind of remarkable. But Republicans in the House voted for it, and but they are all going to be at the ribbon cuttings. You can be sure of that.
All right, let's leave it on that note. I'm going to let you go. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org for more information, up-to-date information. You take care. Best of the holidays to you and everybody at the AFL-CIO.
Thank you, too.
Hopefully, we'll have some good news at the end of January when we link up with you, okay?
We'll keep working on it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Lasker from the Office of Professional Employees, Local 453 out of Massachusetts. He's next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without iron workers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained iron workers and 20,000 apprentices, the Iron Workers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Iron Workers, the sky's the limit.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And you can check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle at AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to Massachusetts right now. Joining us on our live line is Tim Lasker. Tim is president of the Office of Professional Employees, OPIEU, Local 453. The website is just that, OPIEU453.org. And they have about 440 members, and they deal with the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority primarily. Tim Lasker, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So, did I get all that correct about 440 members? Maybe you can give me some more details. You're president for how long? What's the status of the union over there?
We're about 440. We're the second largest at the, it's called the MBTA to the locals, or more fondly, the T. And we are unique in that we are a mid-level management union in all 39 departments at the MBTA. So we have our eyes and ears on the ground in every department. The MBTA is the second. It's the first transit authority in North America, but it's also the fifth largest in North America. And we really deal with a lot of issues, surprisingly, that you wouldn't think that a management union deals with. And the issues are not dissimilar to the rank and file of other union. We have contracts, we have accretion motions to add to the to our membership. We have internal issues with members and their direct reports. We are working with management constantly on important issues, like in the Transit Authority, safety is number one. We deal with the general public. So we've had hazard issues dealing with COVID. So there are a whole slew of different issues that an organization like ours has to deal with.
Yeah, we're talking technical, professional, clerical, supervisory positions. And it's interesting to note, and that caught my attention when I saw that on your website, management union. I mean, it's usually you got management and then you have the rank and file. But this is a management union. I get that now. That's interesting. So the issues here, and I know COVID has changed everything, especially those on the front lines. Let's start right there, because I know a lot of people that were involved in transit got sick because of that. Now, your management, it's a little bit different there. Can you explain the dynamics there, Tim?
Well, I would say that 60% of my members were able to work from home. And those are the type of folks that deal from everything from payroll to procurement to IT, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
The other 40% were out in the field. And we have a large amount of a title called supervisors. And those supervisors manage the maintenance facilities. Like, we have 11 maintenance facilities that they're at all over the Boston metropolitan area. And they also deal with what is called train and bus operations. So they're the ones that are sending out the buses in the morning and the afternoon shifts. They're the ones that are running the subways. We have four different lines. We have the blue line, the red line, and the orange line, which are called heavy rail. Then we have the green line, which is light rail, like more going down the center of a street, that kind of thing, even though there are underground within the city. In fact, the MBTA is the only authority, it might be SEPTA in Philly, but I don't think so, that has every single form of transportation. We have commuter rail. As I mentioned, we have the two different types of trains. We have buses, we have bus trolleys, we have even have ferries that go to different points into the city that we manage. So those are the people that were in jeopardy during COVID, were the ones that were out in the field or at the maintenance facility.
What about the finances here? I know when the pandemic hit, ridership was low. Then the CARES Act came in, and I saw this. I saw your op-ed on this. If the agency cuts service, it'll take years to recover. And then there's some throwing out that evil word, privatization. Okay, you could pick it up from there, Tim.
Well, that's something. I've been doing this for 4 years, and that's something that, regrettably, we've been fighting for a while. We have a very well respected and a highly regarded Republican governor, Charlie Baker, and on a lot of issues I agree with Governor Baker on. He is definitely to the left of most of the Republicans in this country, and that's probably why he was elected governor in this state. One of his pet peeves, though, is that he does not agree that unions should be part of the process. And from day one, we have been fighting privatization along with our sister unions, the Carmen, which is 589 and part of the International ATU, and other OPI unions like TEA and 600. In fact, it's kind of ironic. There are 18 unions at the MBTA. So you can imagine the kind of issues that we run into. But the bottom line is the governor has been pushing really hard to privatize. And when I mentioned the idea, one of the things that we're working on, we filed right before Thanksgiving an accretion motion with the Labor Commission. And we are literally going after over 125 positions that over the last 4 years were hired as quote unquote non-affiliated executives. So that's not privatization per se, but it's saying we don't want your positions to be part of the union anymore. So it's the way of kind of eating away at our base of our membership.
So what kind of support do you have in the legislature right now, Tim?
That's a good question. It's a heavily Democratic legislature, not surprising. We're talking about Massachusetts.
Sure.
I have to admit, I haven't gotten the reaction that I would like to get out of the legislature. I want to be diplomatic about this and politically correct.
But I hear you.
For lack of a better expression, it's a good old boy network. And even the women that have been elected over the last, a decade, a lot of them have had to play that game to get anything done. But just over the last couple of years, there have been some really refreshing changes. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that we have a newly elected Mayor Michelle Wu. She is the first woman and the first woman of color to be elected as mayor of Boston. And she replaces Marty Walsh, who obviously went on to become labor secretary. So we don't have any problem with that. But I think Mayor Wu's election, and more than likely the election coming up to replace Charlie Baker in 2022, is really the Attorney General Maura Healey's race to lose. She hasn't announced formally yet, but she is the leading candidate. We may actually have, in 1 year, the first woman elected governor and the first woman elected mayor. So things are changing. The dynamics are changing. And both of these women represent a younger, more vibrant constituency, which is really, I think, great, because that's something I've also tried to do in our union is my e-board is most of them are a lot younger than me. I mean, like they're almost my kids' age. But I take pride in that, because if we're going to keep this process going, we got to get the younger employees and workers involved. And I'm sure you've heard on your podcast, you know, a lot of them don't even know what a union is. They don't even know what a union represents.
I hear you, Tim, but on the other side of the coin, there's a lot of young people that are sick and tired of their jobs, and they're quitting their jobs, or they're going union in those jobs because they've been deemed essential workers. They're not getting paid as such. They were heroes. Now they're zeros. So things are changing, and we're seeing an uptick in organizing here. So I'm just trying to remain as optimistic as possible. You do have an interesting state, though. I mean, Massachusetts, traditionally a Democratic state, home of the Kennedys for many, many years, and still is. But you've got Republican governors, Charlie Baker, and then you go back to Romney. I mean, you have interesting politics going on in that state. So I would imagine it keeps your head spinning at times. But nonetheless, you got to remain positive, and you are president, business manager of the union. So onward and upward, right? So I'm going to have to leave it on that note there. Tim, thank you for joining us. Tim Lasker, OPEIU453.org is the website for more information. Let's keep in touch in the new year, okay?
I look forward to it, and have a great holiday. Take care.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, it's our segment on working class perspectives and the United Steelworkers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.